A case of the novel coronavirus confirmed in San Antonio, though the patient's quarantined. How officials fight the spread of fear. That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. Other stories we're tracking: is one of the most beloved and pristine corners of our state endangered by energy development? The conversation underway in Big Bend country. The U.S. Border Patrol in the media spotlight of late. Are recent policies or the agency's past more to blame? A new report suggests the latter. Plus, the week that was in Texas politics and a whole lot more as the Friday edition of the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 14th day of February. Happy Valentine's, one and all. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Had a spirited conversation this morning about the most romantic place in Texas. What is it? You can make a case for the Driscoll Hotel Bar in Austin, but rather than do that, here's an idea. Let's see what Texas Standard listeners have to say on the subject. Tweet us at Texas Standard or find us on Facebook. And even if we can't get a consensus by the end of the broadcast, maybe we can discover something new. Most romantic place in Texas. La Quinta in Midland? They say all's fair in love and war, but when it comes to war with Iran, as you may have heard, a bipartisan effort to limit the president's powers has passed the Senate, albeit without the support of Texas's two senators who oppose the move. An expected presidential veto is not likely to be overridden. One of those two Texas senators is up for re-election, and something tells me John Cornyn's vote might come up as an issue in the first statewide Senate debate among his Democratic challengers on Tuesday. More on that later in the broadcast. By now, you may have heard the 15th confirmed case of coronavirus in the U.S. is also the first confirmed case in Texas. They're now calling the disease COVID-19. The patient's been under a 14-day federal quarantine at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio since arriving in the U.S. from China on a chartered evacuation flight back on February 7th. The Centers for Disease Control identifies the person as a solo traveler who's been isolated and is now getting medical care at a hospital. San Antonio health officials say they're satisfied with how quickly the case was detected and isolated from the public at large, but stopping the spread of fear remains a challenge. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie has more.
Good morning. Thank you for being here.
San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg was flanked by representatives of the city, the county, the state, and the Centers for Disease Control when he made his announcement.
We are here to notify you that the Centers for Disease Control has confirmed a case of the coronavirus, properly called COVID-19, in San Antonio.
It wasn't a surprise. Well, not really. 91 evacuees from Wuhan, China, have been quarantined at the Gateway Hotel at Lackland Air Force Base because they're at high risk of having been exposed to the virus in that city, the epicenter of this outbreak. CDC Captain Jennifer McQuiston says that's why they're being quarantined.
When we find someone in quarantine or are able to keep them isolated, that is the entire reason for it.
So how did they determine this traveler was sick? McQuiston says they're monitoring all of them for signs of illness all the time, and they take their temperatures twice a day. It was during a temperature check that this evacuee came to the CDC's attention.
This patient was identified as having a fever the morning of February 11th, and they were transported to the hospital that morning, and samples were taken and sent to CDC overnight.
And Tuesday evening, CDC confirmed the patient had been infected with COVID-19. So the quarantine, according to everyone who lined up behind Nirenberg Wednesday morning, is working just the way it's supposed to. But when the patient left Lackland, they and the virus were out amongst the rest of us here in San Antonio and headed to Methodist Hospital, Texan. Are we safe? McQuiston says absolutely, starting with the care taken getting the patient from Lackland to the hospital in an ambulance.
This is a special infectious disease response ambulance.
That's San Antonio Fire Chief Charles Hood.
It is dedicated to this event throughout. It will not be used on the streets of the city of San Antonio.
So San Antonio has a dedicated infectious disease ambulance.
Also, we have over 30 members, the first team in the state, dedicated as an infectious disease response unit.
Once the ambulance arrived at the hospital, The patient was escorted through what Methodist Texan calls a secluded entrance to avoid other people. Everyone who deals with the patient is in protective gear. And now, CDC Captain McQuiston says, the patient is in a room that has negative pressure.
Meaning that air does not flow out, it only flows in. And they are in isolation, and people who go in to take care of that patient are in full protective gear.
There is a federal marshal stationed outside the room, mostly to keep unauthorized and unprotected people from getting in, but also to keep the patient from getting out. And back at the Gateway Hotel at Lackland, where those 90 other evacuees are waiting eagerly for their quarantine to end, McQuiston says their spirits remain high.
Some of them are taking classes. So they're trying to carry on life as they can behind the fence, as we call it.
It may turn out that other evacuees do have COVID-19, and they may get sick before the quarantine ends. Now, some people may be mad that evacuees from China were brought to San Antonio in the first place. McQuiston says she understands that.
But I think it's really important to also have empathy for people who might be caught in China, who should be in America and cannot get back, and think about what it would be like if you or a loved one was over there and what you would want us to do for them.
McQuiston added,
we're Americans. We bring our people home and we take care of them.
The quarantine at Lackland is projected to end on February 20th. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
With six major flooding events and disaster declarations in each of the past 5 years, one might be inclined to think that Houston is looking at a new normal. Well, that seems to be the position that Texas's biggest metropolis is taking with the release of a 186-page document purporting to be a kind of master plan to prepare Houston for the next big disaster. The idea is to create what Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner calls a resilient city, and Marissa Ajo is the city of Houston's chief resilience officer. Ms. Ajo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
I understand having a plan for weather emergencies and the like, but what is a resilience plan?
Well, a resilience strategy, as we call them, is really to look at both acute shocks and chronic stresses that we experience on a day-to-day basis, but are exacerbated by a disruption or an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And how to basically solve for more than one thing at the same time and increase our preparedness so that communities can survive, adapt, and thrive in the face of changing climate and adversity.
Give us a specific example. Like, for instance, I mean, let me just throw this out there. Hurricane Harvey strikes. Do you turn to this resilience plan? Is it like a guidebook or not? Something different?
There are things in it that could guide someone, but the way that we've designed it is so that we focus on individual resilience, neighborhood resilience, bayou resilience, city resilience, and regional resilience as a framework for recognizing that everybody has a role to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so and any individual could look at chapter one, individual resilience, and there are things that they could do today, and there are things that they could do to prepare for a future event.
So it's not so much in case of emergency, break glass kind of document. What it is you're sort of getting all the agencies, all the departments, all the different arms of Houston on board with sort of, so you're going in the same direction, sounds like.
Yes. So Mayor Turner has been talking a lot about alignment and that our alignment is going to lead to transformational change. And so that is the premise for the strategy.
One of the key parts of this plan, as I understand it, is removing all habitable structures from the city's floodway. For those who don't know, those in other parts of Texas, what is the floodway and how much land are you talking about here?
Sure. So the floodway is the immediate area next to the bayou. So it's not the 100-year floodplain or the 500-year floodplain. It's the immediate, most adjacent area to the bayou.
So you're talking about a buyout of that area or what?
So there are already, voluntary buyout opportunities that exist and have for quite some time. What we're trying to look at is that, that's those are places where there's repetitive flooding. And if we can help, help families relocate to areas that are either in the same school district or in the same neighborhood, we're really looking at what we are calling a buy-in, buy-out approach of, continuing to be in a community, buying into that community. Lots of people have generations of history in a community, but their particular home may have suffered repetitive flooding. What can we do to, look at a coordinated effort that ultimately, and it's a 10-year goal, ultimately looks at many different types of resources that we could use to achieve that goal.
That sounds like it could get expensive. Do you have a price tag on all the things that you want to accomplish with this resiliency plan?
So part of this plan is, a vision, and part of it is really a way to attract different partners. And our next step, which started yesterday, is really looking at, continuing implementation, gathering some of those partners, looking at each of the 62 actions that are in the strategy, and coming up with, continuing the discussions about how exactly they'll be implemented and what the specific budgets will be. So I will have a busy next year, let's just say that.
It sounds like you will. Marissa Ajo is the Chief Resiliency Officer for the City of Houston, which has just released a new 186-page document, kind of master plan for, changes coming to Houston and how the city's going to deal with those changes. Ms. Ajo, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Friday. Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, see what folks are talking about.
Hi, David. Controversy over the Justice Department reducing sentencing recommendations for Trump associate Roger Stone sparking lots of talk on social media. Now, Attorney General William Barr claims Trump's tweets about the case, such as a recent message calling prison time for Stone unfair, make it impossible for the AG to do his job. Mm. In an interview with ABC News, Attorney General Barr added, quote, "I'm not going to be bullied or influenced by anybody." On our Facebook page, Joshua Dodds writes, "When a yes man like Barr starts to push back and say no, you know you're dealing with an out-of-control leader." However, Tiffany Coulson isn't convinced by Barr's show of independence, saying, "You know it's all an act." Meanwhile, Eric Ballantyne, also on our Facebook page, he offers that Trump should be careful of the optics tweeting about cases under process. Even though the Stone case is 100% Democrat revenge for losing the election, Eric says Trump should tone down his tweets. Just a mix of the reactions we're seeing out there, David. I'll be back with more this Valentine's Day.
Yeah, well, you can bank on that. Of course, if we haven't heard from you yet, what you waiting for? Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, back in about 35 minutes or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In many respects, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is using Texas as the first real-world launchpad for his Democratic presidential bid. His visit to Houston this week, a specific outreach for the African-American vote. But as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports, that's proving to be a special challenge.
Hundreds packed Houston's Buffalo Soldiers Museum to hear Bloomberg speak. Among them was 85-year-old Edith King.
I'm familiar with his philanthropic work in Harlem, the millions that he's contributed to housing for the elderly, for low-income families.
Also there was Kenneth John Campbell, a retired U.S. Navy Master Chief.
Well, he's a true businessman. I don't think he's declared bankruptcy six or seven times, and I think he's honest. You know, he has a credible track record. I think he can do more for this country than the current administration.
Spacious skies forever.
Gospel singer Yolanda Adams repeated her Super Bowl performance of America the Beautiful. Then Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said he'd spoken with Bloomberg about the police practice of stop and frisk Bloomberg had enacted as mayor of New York.
It's important for me to hear that a recognition that the policy that was put in place was not the right policy. that it was flawed, that it was insensitive, and a public apology that it was wrong. And in order for me to move forward, those are the sort of things that I needed to hear. And I heard that.
Stop and frisk was the first issue Bloomberg addressed when he took the stage. He said that when he became mayor, he was determined to crack down on gun violence and save lives. But he said the policy of stop and frisk was abusive and a mistake.
I defended it, looking back, for too long because I didn't understand then the unintended pain it was causing to young black and brown families and their kids. I should have acted sooner and faster to stop it. I didn't, and for that I apologized.
Then Bloomberg laid out his proposals. He pledged to combat systemic racism everywhere, from the courts to the healthcare system. He said he would triple the funding for historically black colleges and universities, and he focused heavily on issues of economic justice.
Just think about this. If we could eliminate the racial wealth gap in this generation, we could add $1.5 trillion to the U.S. economy. Everyone would benefit. What's not to love? And so what are we waiting for?
Bloomberg ended by encouraging the audience to tell their friends and family members to get out and vote. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Texas's Big Bend region is beloved in large part because of its wildness. There are places between I-10 and the southern border that still feel untouched today. But that could be changing. As technology improves, areas that were previously closed off to oil and gas exploration could become open, and that could include the Big Bend. To wit, the Borderlands Research Institute at Sol Ross State University in Alpine is hosting a series of talks on what the area's future might look like as an extraction zone. Joining us now to tell us more is Billy Tarrant. He's the Institute's Associate Director of Stewardship Services. Mr. Tarrant, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I suppose we should start by getting a sense of what the state of energy development in the Big Bend actually is. Now, I know that just up the road a little bit to your north and west, you got quite a bit right there around I-10, a lot of development there. What's it looking like between I-10 and the southern border?
Well, this effort is really focused in the Tri-County area right now, and that's the area around Marfa, Alpine, Marathon, Fort Davis, on down to Presidio, in those three counties, Brewster, Jeff Davis, and Presidio counties. Not a lot of development there now. We've got a little bit of solar, a new solar farm that's gone in near Alpine, but right now most of that development is further north, and obviously there's a lot up there.
I would imagine that one of the most contentious has to do with oil extraction, but as you were talking about, there's solar farms going up there, and I would guess that some of those are not exactly the most beautiful to look at, certainly against the desert and the mountains.
Yeah, that's all forms of energy, while they are absolutely necessary, do come at some price, you know, and that's kind of why this effort was born, which we've entitled Respect Big Bend. It's for the purpose of trying to figure out how to balance, you know, good responsible energy development and holding on to the things that we cherish about, you know, that wild country, the last frontier, if you will, far west Texas.
Now, I know that y'all recently hosted a talk about what to expect and how to prepare for all the new development. What were you hearing from folks? I mean, what was the upshot of that conversation?
You know, the Respect Big Bend coalition, this initiative that we've been involved with, one of our partners in this coalition is the Bureau of Economic Geology, and it's been their responsibility to come up with projections. And, you know, from what they were able to ascertain to this point is we don't see a whole lot of oil and gas development in that greater Big Bend region, you know, directly around Big Bend National Park. It's more prone for right now, at least, for wind and solar. A lot of resources for wind and solar there, just not a lot of transmission at this point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But eventually, I would imagine there's a concern about build-out of infrastructure, right?
Right, exactly. And that's kind of where we're spending a lot of time right now is visiting with folks at the Public Utilities Commission and ERCOT to try to figure out what plans may be in the works. But I was amazed to find out in that area there's been over 1,000 oil and gas wells drilled in the last 100 years. But for the most part, they have not been productive. Now, that said, it doesn't mean that they won't be in the future. I mean, mm-hmm. part of the impetus for this entire effort was the Alpine High development there near Balmoray. And I don't think that was on anybody's radar at one point either.
Mm-hmm. What about the oil and gas companies? What have they been like when it comes to talking about, you know, balancing opportunities with preserving the ecological integrity of such a special place?
You know, industry has said they want to be at the table and they want to be able to hear what the concerns are. Mm-hmm. Most of your better producers, you know, the ones that are more responsible, have some type of stakeholder engagement within their company. They've said to us, you know, it's easier to go ahead and understand what the wants and needs of the community are ahead of time versus nobody really wants a fight. That's not all the producers, obviously. That's a select group that we have on that stakeholder advisory group. But our goal is to work with those partners and provide opportunities primarily for landowners, which I got to back up and say, you know, landowners own the surface rights. So they are able to dictate whether or not wind or solar opportunities will occur on their property. Fortunately, most of that country versus a lot of the rest of Texas, the landowners still own controlling interest in the minerals. So, but that said, you know, many of those properties are, you know, they're large, expansive ranches, and they've been in the four generations worth of ownership with the same family. But it's a tough place to make a living too, and so they got to think about those opportunities. They may not want to develop. They may not want to lose those view sheds and the things that we all cherish about that country. And our goal is to go ahead and try to find where can we find some common ground in some of these special places? And B, can we provide you, Mr. Landowner, the tools and resources you need to make the best decision and hopefully maybe even in some areas not develop, maybe incentivize non-development.
Billy Tarrant is the Associate Director of Stewardship Services at Borderlands Research Institute, Sul Ross State University in Alpine. Mr. Tarrant, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your schedule to speak with us on the Texas Standard. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, same here. My honor. Appreciate it so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is visiting Texas today. KERA's Justin Martin has a preview of his campaign stop in the Dallas area.
The Vermont senator will hold a rally tonight at the Mesquite Arena. Doors open at 6 and the event begins at 8. The rally follows news that the Sanders campaign is ramping up operations in Texas with new field offices in Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and McAllen. Since last week's Iowa caucuses, national polls show Sanders has taken the lead over Joe Biden as the top choice of Democrats. Early voting in the Texas primary starts Tuesday and runs through February 28th. Election day is March 3rd. I'm Justin Martin in Dallas.
The Democratic-controlled U.S. House is hoping to revive the Equal Rights Amendment following a vote Thursday to remove the deadline on ratifying it. The vote fell almost entirely along party lines, with only 5 Republicans backing the measure and no Democrats opposing it. Speaking on the House floor yesterday, Houston Democrat Sylvia Garcia urged her colleagues to back the resolution.
We're voting to remove an arbitrary deadline so we can finally prohibit gender discrimination under the Constitution.
The measure passed yesterday removes a 1982 deadline for 38 states to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment so it can be included in the Constitution. However, it's unlikely the Republican-led Senate or Trump administration will back the resolution to remove the ratification deadline. A vigil will be held in Houston later today, marking 2 years since the mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
Members of March for Our Lives Houston plan to hold the vigil at 6 this afternoon at Emancipation Park. In a statement, the group says it wants to remember and honor the 17 victims of gun violence who died at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Following that 2018 mass shooting, March for Our Lives became a nationwide student-led movement calling on lawmakers to pass gun control measures. The South Florida shooting came just a few months before an attack at Santa Fe High School near Houston, which left 10 people dead and more than a dozen injured. That spurred Texas lawmakers to pass several school safety measures during the 2019 legislative session, which schools are still in the process of implementing. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
The number of flowers and plants being transported across the U.S.-Mexico border is expected to increase with the Valentine's Day holiday. U.S. Customs and Border Protection is reminding people that some items can harbor harmful pests and diseases and are prohibited at ports of entry. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University. Focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
This is the Texas Standard. Over the last two decades, the U.S. Border Patrol has grown steadily from nearly 4,000 agents to more than 19,000. But with that growth have come some growing pains playing out for all the world to see. In her latest piece for ProPublica, Melissa Del Bosque looks into the few agents from a small Border Patrol outpost who rose through the ranks to lead it and what's happened to them. Melissa, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
This is a long and eye-opening history, quite the timeline you've laid out here. Why is it important to tell the story going back in time, given that so much has been going on with the Border Patrol of late?
Right. I mean, you know, since Trump took office, of course, we've been hearing about, you know, misconduct and mistreatment of migrants at the border. And, you know, it's been in the news a lot, and the Border Patrol has been under a lot of scrutiny. But actually, these problems go back many, many decades, and they sort of pop up cyclically. I've been writing about the Border Patrol for more than a decade, so I've seen these problems come up over and over and over again. So I really wanted to look at the leadership culture and sort of dig deeper and examine why these problems keep coming up over and over again in the Border Patrol.
I was struck by your comment that before 1990, the Border Patrol was largely a sort of a kind of a congressional footnote, in a sense, in terms of the way that members of Congress thought about the agency. And now, of course, it's been occupying many headlines of late. You seem to tie back the troubles that the Border Patrol has been having to a place called Douglas. Tell us about where that is and why that's so important.
Sure. Yeah. Douglas, Arizona is a little town, a little border town, not far from the New Mexico state line, actually. And at the turn of the century, you know, in 2000, it was the biggest border patrol and the busiest border patrol station in the nation. And they had about 650 agents, and they were apprehending about, you know, 2,500 people a day. So at this time, this, you know, there was this big ramping up of staff there in Douglas. And so this was one of the first sort of like mega Border Patrol stations that we saw in Border Patrol history.
It sort of set a kind of template or a standard. You started, I think you talk about how people in the Border Patrol would refer to the Douglas Mafia.
Right. Yeah. The leaders of the current Border Patrol all came out of Douglas because this was the biggest Border Patrol and the busiest Border Patrol station 20 years ago. That's where a lot of the current leaders got their start.
But what I think that you're suggesting is that there was a kind of a mindset, a sort of us versus them mentality that made Douglas in a way what it was once upon a time, and maybe characterizing to a greater extent what the Border Patrol is like today?
Yeah, I think one of the Border Patrol's biggest problems and biggest challenges is that it rapidly expanded in a short amount of time. And Douglas is sort of the last 20 years of the Border Patrol encapsulated, because it was this tiny little agency that could, you know, with for 40 agents that expanded in a few short months into, you know, 500 agents. And so there was this rapid influx of just hiring people and promoting people. So people were being brought in without really proper background checks. People were being promoted who weren't really ready to lead. And that's kind of where a lot of the problems that we're seeing now started, was back in Douglas. And, 20 years ago, when these people started rising through the ranks who really weren't probably the best people for the job.
Well, was nobody pointing that out to members of Congress or to, I mean, what about regulators, the accountability, that sort of thing?
Well, Congress has never really put adequate oversight on the Border Patrol, and this is part of the problem, is that, you know, the Border Patrol as a culture is very insular. They're very, very protective. And I think they feel often, you know, over-politicized and isolated. So they have this sort of sense of like it's us against them and we have to protect ourselves. So they're really resistant to oversight and they're resistant to outside criticism because I think they feel like, you know, they've sort of been given an unfair deal and they're doing the best that they can do. And I think this sort of feeling of us versus them has sort of permeated the leadership so that they're resistant to reform, they're resistant to oversight from outside.
And there are other issues related to this, including issues of attrition within the Border Patrol and its future. You should definitely check out this piece on the U.S. Border Patrol. It's been published by ProPublica, and the author is Melissa Del Bosque, who's been covering the border for more than a decade. We'll have a link to it over at texasstandard.org. Melissa, thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
My name is Tanya Miller.
And I'm Leon Miller. I'm Tanya's husband.
We are newlyweds as of December the 29th. Kind of a interesting story. Actually, we were married to each other. Our first, we married in 2005. We were married for 12 years. We divorced in 2017.
And I even tried to date. That was weird. She left Texas altogether and she just got away from Texas.
We filed for divorce in June, maybe I think June. And then July, I was in Tampa. You know, you don't realize sometimes when you do things, you know, I allowed my children, I have two children from a previous marriage, even as they became adults, they were still priority. So it was like I put my husband on the back burner. You know, he felt unappreciated and, you know,
disrespected.
You know,
the kids.
They were in and out and it was me and not really asking him, not really consulting him about having them come back to live with us when they're adults, you know, and, you know, he would just come home and they'd be back.
When you don't feel appreciated, then you might do something stupid that you shouldn't do. I did some things that I shouldn't have done.
When we divorced, I had ovarian cancer and I had surgery in 2017. Leon and I have never really talked about that. It made me feel like I wasn't whole. And, you know, thankfully, you know, I'm in remission. I'm doing great. It was just kind of scary.
She didn't talk about it that much to me. This is the most I've heard about it, you know, now.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, she didn't tell me that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna throw God in the mix. God, you know, I just say God works in mysterious ways. You say you don't miss your water till the well runs dry. Sometimes it takes some strong move or something to get somebody's attention. And time is too precious to be wasting. And a lot of times, you know, people out there trying to date and date, you really wasting time. And then you miss out on the person that you're supposed to be with.
And here we are, married again for the second time.
For life.
I know it's forever. I know in my heart it's forever.
Yeah. I'm like,
and we agree that it's forever. Like, it's nothing is perfect. We know that, but it's all about how we deal with it together. It's no individual thing anymore.
That's right.
We are each other's priority.
I started, you know, appreciating her beauty and her things about her and stuff, and I would tell her. and we communicate better, I believe. So yeah. We're trying to make the most of it, trying to be the best husband, the best wife, the best communicator, the best parent, best lover, because you don't need to be living a mediocre life. God wants to have an epic life.
You know, there is hope. Our story is a testimony. It's not for us to hold in, it's for us to share.
Go ahead, babe.
Okay, this is Tanya Miller.
And this is Leon Miller, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
44 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Since 2007, artist Michael Rakowitz has created replicas of Iraqi cultural artifacts destroyed by war. But the artist doesn't use stone. Instead, he crafts his works from Iraqi food packaging. Yes, you heard me correctly. Well, this got the attention of the Nasher Sculpture Center, the Contemporary Art Museum in Dallas, which, as Miguel Perez of KERA reports, awarded the Chicago-based Rakowitz with a 2020 Nasher Prize and threw a barbecue in his honor.
It wasn't brisket and ribs on the menu, but Syrian grilled chicken, fattoush salad, and a smorgasbord of Middle Eastern dishes. Dressed in a white chef's jacket, Michael Rakowitz was in his element, helping serve hungry crowds by drizzling fresh fruit with tahini and Iraqi date syrup.
The date syrup is actually processed in the Iraqi capital, put into large plastic vats, then driven over the border into Syria, where it gets put into unmarked tin plate steel cans, and then driven over the border into Lebanon, where it gets labeled and is sold to the rest of the world.
The Iraqi Jewish artist says disguising the syrup as a Lebanese product gives it a chance of getting out into the world.
I started to build my entire practice around this can of date syrup, and it was almost as if the pressures of xenophobia had been exerted onto this object that was so terrified that it couldn't tell me where it was from.
Those cans became the building blocks for Rakowitz's work.
I'm making those objects out of traces of the visibility of Arabic culture throughout the United States, the packaging of Middle Eastern foodstuffs and Arabic English newspapers.
His most well-known piece is a recreation of the Lamassu, winged stone deities, thousands of years old, that guarded an ancient Iraqi city. In 2015, they were destroyed by ISIS. Rakowitz's Lamassu is built from bright green and yellow date cans and currently sits in Trafalgar Square in London. It's just one on a long list of works he hopes to replicate.
In the 14 years since I started that project, my studio and I have made about 900 of those artifacts. And so it is a work that will outlive me and my studio.
The art world has praised Rakowitz for his politically charged work. And in April, the Nasher Sculpture Center will present him with their annual prize. It comes with $100,000. It's the largest prize in the sculpture world. But Rakowitz is more than just a sculptor. He also deals in the exchange of culture through food, an ethos he shares with the women of Break Bread, Break Borders, the Dallas nonprofit catering company behind today's feast. All its employees are refugees of war. It's an economic opportunity for the women and an educational one for the public. Founder Jinya Huang says her mother inspired her to start the company 2 years ago.
I chose to create Break Bread, Break Borders as a community dinner to kind of connect people through food because it's such a wonderful equalizer. For my mom, it was such an amazing universal language.
A language Rakowitz has used in past projects, like in a 2017 one called Enemy Kitchen. Rakowitz took to the streets of Chicago to serve his own mother's Iraqi recipes. He recruited combat veterans to cook in a food truck alongside Iraqi chefs.
You know, they're working with the spices that they would smell in the market, but they were never allowed to eat on their own. It's something that they're learning, and what some of the work has done is ask for those veterans not to speak about how the war changed them, but rather how Iraq changed them.
The through line in his work, from sculptures to food trucks, is an attempt to combat what Rakowitz calls cultural amnesia.
How do we do things like humanize Iraq and Iraqis and pull it out of the frame of war, out of the frame of conflict, and do something to restore some dignity to it?
Sharing a plate of fresh fruit drizzled in Iraqi date syrup is a good place to start. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
Michael Rakowicz returns to Dallas in April to accept the Nasher Prize. Could it be that the most romantic place in Texas is in San Antonio? I'm not so sure. I mean, that seems to be what listeners are telling us. Have you let us know what you think the most romantic place in Texas is? Tweet us right now at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com.
I'm Sean Petrie. I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. And the Typewriter Rodeo, we make up poems on the spot on whatever topic people want. Childhood memories of squeaking and slamming screened doors. A listener request for Gene Henry. You walked in and everyone knew. That squeak of the hinge, they would oil someday. That slap of wood on wood as the door gave itself a high five. And everyone turned and knew you. Because this was the place you all gathered. Part grocery store, part lunchtime deli, part just sit and gossip. While the air buzzed with chatter and laughter, and that sandwich was made to order, and you just felt like you belonged. And now, today, that highway has bypassed the old town. But sometimes, still, you just pull over on a forgotten patch of road, and you can still hear them, those old doors squeaking and slamming as you smile. For the Texas Standard, I'm Sean Petrie with the Typewriter Rodeo.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
The Typewriter Rodeo works by request. Send us yours. Texas Standard at KUT.org. Then make sure to join us each and every Friday. You can find the Typewriter Rodeo on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, too. Before we kick off the weekend, we want to take time to recap the week that was in Texas politics. For that, we're joined by Alex Samuels, reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, welcome.
Yes, of course.
First off, new Texas Tribune UT poll out this morning about presidential politics in the Lone Star State. What's the top line takeaway, would you say?
So what's interesting is that Bernie Sanders has doubled his support among Democratic voters in Texas. So he's now ahead of former Vice President Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, who led, they were two leaders in the October UT Texas Tribune poll.
Is this the result of what's been going on in Iowa and New Hampshire or what?
I think that's definitely part of it. Another thing is that in our last poll, we still had Beto O'Rourke. I think we had Julian Castro in there too. Now, of course, they're out of the race, so it's interesting to see where their support is going. But I think this, we were in the field prior to Iowa, New Hampshire, per my knowledge.
Oh, well, that makes sense. I want to pivot, if we can, to Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who's getting involved in the primaries, as I understand it. How so?
So he's embarking on a statewide tour to get out the vote for at least 10 Republican incumbents and candidates.
Oh, well, that's interesting. What's he planning on doing? Like rallies, campaign rallies, joint appearances, that sort of thing?
I believe so. I think he's just hitting the road for them and, you know, knocking on doors, helping them try to get out the vote. It's interesting because he's going on the road for at least four members in the Texas House who have primary challenges. I think that's Jeannie Morrison, J.D. Sheffield, Briscoe Kane, and Jared Patterson. But then he's also helping Republicans who are trying to flip seats that Democrats currently hold.
Let's move over to the Senate Democratic primary field. These are the challengers. Want to take on John Cornyn, longtime Republican senator. Crowded field among the Democrats, but the Trib this week just unveiled something of a voter guide, as I understand it.
Yes. So we highlighted some of the leading candidates. So that's Christina Sinsoon Ramirez, Amanda Edwards, Royce West, MJ Hagar, and Chris Bell. And we asked their opinions on various issues to try and see where they stand on the issue. So we'll see, of course, if any or some of them make it out of the primary, which is and then hopefully likely runoff.
Yeah, in fact, there's a very special event that is coming up on February 18th that we're sort of jointly participating in. This would be, what, the first real debate in this Senate race?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, and but John Cornyn's not going to be a part of this. These are just the Democrats, right?
Mm-hmm. Just the Democrats. And to my knowledge, it's 11 of the 12 Democrats have been confirmed to participate.
That
in
is
field.
Amazing.
So it'll be a pretty big...
Yeah, it's going to be a lot to chuckle, that's for sure. if you want to hear more from the candidates, of course, you can tune in to that special primary debate on February 18th with pre-debate coverage provided by us right here at the Texas Standard. The debate itself brought to you by our home station, KUT, KVU TV, and the Texas Tribune. That is where Alex Samuels is based as political reporter for the Trib. We'll have more on the debate and everything else over at texasstandard.org. Alex, good to talk with you again. Hope you have a great weekend.
Yes, of course. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. All right. With it being Friday and all, let's check in one more time with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, and see what Texans are talking about on this Valentine's Day.
Yes, sir. Well, is Texas feeling the burn? Folks are talking about that new UT Austin Texas Tribune poll. We just heard about that poll showing Bernie Sanders leading the Democratic hopefuls here in Texas. On our Facebook page, Kelly Conrad Simon says she's excited to see the movement in preferences that Sanders' lead represents. She says Democrats are listening. Thomas Fullerton Hopper, he says, I would certainly prefer a discussion of Senator Sanders' legislative accomplishments there. I think trying to dampen the enthusiasm some. Meanwhile, Brittany Lalu says she is ready to vote in March. And yeah, that's going to be here sooner than we know it, as
you
we were just talking about.
March 3rd.
Well, speaking of voting, we have a poll up on our Facebook page asking about the sometimes divisive holiday that is Valentine's. Is it
sometimes
the best?
Divisive, huh?
Yeah, is it the best? Or the absolute worst in the eyes of some detractors. No need to wait till Super Tuesday to sound off here, but before we get to those results, here's a sampling of what some folks are telling us.
Right.
Blanca Houston, she says, I look at Valentine's as a don't take your loved one for granted day. Good way of thinking about it there. Mm. Love this comment from Leah Keese, regular commenter and listener. She says, it's just another day that I remind my amazing husband how lucky he was that he snagged me and how smart I was to have snagged him. 13 years married, 14 together, gone through toddlers, teenagers, booms, bus deployments, and many, many home moves. I wouldn't change a thing.
Congratulations.
Meanwhile, Daniel Lozano says he'll just be at home with tears streaming down his face. Well, I count the money I save from being single. You know, silver linings and whatnot. I like it.
So romantic.
And as promised, yes, as of this writing, what's the poll results here via Facebook? A scant 26% say Valentine's is the best, and a whopping 74% say VD is the absolute worst. Still plenty of time to sound off there.
Wow.
The,
you're saying that we have an overwhelming number of listeners who don't like Valentine's Day. That's kind of crazy.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it is what it is.
Well, I guess so. What do you think the most romantic place in Texas is?
Romantic place in Texas. Gosh.
That's what I've been asking for.
I'm here. We're Central Texas, maybe like the top of Mount Bonnell. That's a popular lookout
that's pretty
spot
popular.
Here
yeah,
in the Austin region.
I really like the Driscoll Bar. It has a lot of history, right? LBJ and all that kind
love
of stuff.
That place.
A lot of people, I guess, down San Antonio way saying that the Riverwalk is the most romantic place.
That's a slam dunk.
We did hear from someone who had a very interesting nomination. Said West Texas, staring at the moon on any of our lost highways. Oh, that's romantic indeed. Keep those suggestions coming to Texas Standard. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We'll be back here on Monday. Hope you can join us. Till then, have a wonderfully romantic weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.